We are in New York City in the Children's Museum of Manhattan with its executive director, Andrew Ackerman. Andy Ackerman, welcome.
Thank you.
You just did an introduction. We're actually at a National Science Foundation workshop for the Science of Learning Centers today. There was the ultimate block party yesterday. You just gave an introductory talk, and it kind of struck me that you talked about suffering from a play deficiency.
Mm.
Would you like to sort of explain that?
It's almost like a vitamin deficiency. And in some ways, they're related. Doctors now think that children, their big vitamin deficiency is vitamin D because they're not outside enough. They're not playing enough. When I look at families at the museum or at the ultimate block party, they are so thirsty to play, to relax, and just be themselves in an interactive, fun, challenging environment. The children are so over-tested and over-prepped and over-programmed. It's actually turned the home into almost a battleground because of homework and extra scheduled activities. So what we saw yesterday in Central Park are 50,000 people coming to the park to play, waiting to play, enveloped in play. They were telling us that there's a deficiency in their life, that this is something that they intuitively, instinctually know is critical to their development as a family, not just as child development. So if you watched closely, not only were the kids playing, but the parents are beginning to elbow in so that they can build with the cardboard boxes, or that they could paint, or they can draw, or build a robot on a computer. And they wanted to do it together. So we were feeling this huge breathing in of something that they know is as important for them as nourishment. And one of the problems is nobody's quite listening to that. It's out there. But who's providing it? Who's giving it to them? Who's allowing it almost? Because in American society today, we're feeling the opposite, that if it's not tested, evaluated, programmed, and structured, it's not good.
It's not as if there isn't a huge debate going on about education, though.
But the debate about education is not about this. The debate about education is about curriculum and length of the school year and what should be taught, who should be teaching it. But we know children are not in school that much. Maybe 20 or 25% of their waking hours are spent in school. The rest is spent at home, in museums, in church groups, and that's where most of the learning in our life takes place. I mean, we know from doing interviews with individuals, when we ask them about what was influential in their childhood, it's about turning over a rock in the park. It's about exploring a museum. It's being at the beach. It's something that happened when they were a child that sparked their interest. And most of it's in that 80% when they're not in school. So the education debate, by and large, is leaving out the most important locus of education, which is the family. And so it's wrongheaded. We know in working in places, for example, in the South Bronx, that by the time a child enters kindergarten, 50, 60% are already way behind. Now, remediation is a very expensive, tedious business. So we need to find a way to engage the families as the children are even being born, and as they grow through adolescence, all the way through, that the community needs to be responsible, not just the schools for education. There's plenty of neuroscience and behavioral science and observational science to support all of this. One psychologist who's on our board of directors said, my generation of parents in their 50s decided that there's an equation between success in school and success in life. More than any other generation has ever decided that. And so we skewed everything and almost abdicated our responsibility as parents and communities to the schools, saying, you're responsible. And guess what? It hasn't worked, because the schools can't do all of that. They can't control what goes on outside of the school. And the vast majority of children come from families where the parents care. Parents may not be educated. They may not have had education. They may not speak English, but they care. It's only a tiny percentage of children who don't have parents who care. And yeah, that's a big challenge, but let's look at that big group and let's engage the community in a way from birth where we are helping these kids to learn in a way that's intuitive, that science knows really works, and going to provide the creativity in the 21st century. We are already seeing the results in the workplace right now of a movement that's 15 or 20 years old of didactic learning and drill and kill. So young people entering the workplace, they're waiting for their worksheet. They're waiting for a very specific assignment. And the workplace isn't like that. Yeah, you have to do task A and B, but we want you to go beyond. We want you to innovate. We want you to connect the dots. We want you to be creative. And the way we've structured a child's life right now, they're not prepared for that. And it's exactly what we need in the 21st century. So give me the cardboard box. Give me the crayons. Give me a ball in the backyard or in the park. Let the kids go out and figure out the way we always did, how they make up games, how they make up the rules, how they learn to play in teams. I'll give you another example. We have an early childhood floor at the museum that we spent 3 years researching. And it's for children to prepare them for kindergarten. And we talked to kindergarten teachers. And we said, well, what do you need? And he said, well, the kids are not prepared with the basics. But beyond that, the most important thing, they don't know how to play together. They don't know how to play together anymore. They lack the social skills when they come to kindergarten, to play in groups, to share, to solve problems together. We've not seen that before. And it resonates with me because I see it in the workplace, and other people see it in the workplace. We have to get away from this kind of solitary experience, which technology has contributed to, because it's generally an individual with a screen. So we have all of these deficits. We have a play deficit, a deficiency, and that deficiency is showing up, and it's becoming really a national problem on multiple levels, whether it's economic or, as we're beginning to see, even national security.
You actually took that medical metaphor even further. I mean, we were talking about a patient lying almost moribund on a table here, and for you, play was the oxygen.
It was. You know, we had hoped that the ultimate block party, because we're so ambitious, would be a place where we could do so much for the patient in terms of explaining to them and examining what's wrong. But like in the ER, if a patient comes in and they're not breathing, you'd better get them to breathe. So we had 50,000 people, and I felt like we were administering oxygen. We should have had oxygen tanks. They were beginning to slow down and breathe, both the adults and the kids. And they were so intent on their breathing and on what they were doing that they absorbed very important messages. But we couldn't get to that medical level, if you would, of explaining the science of play equals learning to the point we may have liked to. And you can't do that with a patient who can't breathe.
That's partly what we're here for, and that's partly one of the things we do on the Science of Educating, part of the Science Network. Let me just throw out a perspective that we take and see how it resonates with you. I mean, if I look at the magazines, a very recent Time magazine here, What Makes a School Great, lots of issues of Newsweek and various other things, New York Times, about getting rid of bad teachers, building better teachers, so on. There's I'm just looking at the Daily Beast here. There's a column in there by Diane Ravitch which says, stop trashing teachers. Misguided policies, overhyped doc waiting for Superman have turned America against its teachers. Education expert Diane Ravitch on why the vitriol is so dangerous. Against that, current issue of Neuron, Science Journal, reviews on child brain development. A lot of really good information from here and the other NSF-funded Science of Learning centers about the importance of optimizing this piece of 3 pounds of wonder tissue that's atop of every spinal column in that park yesterday, and I hope we both have some too. To optimize that requires understanding neuroscience, cognitive science, and so on. So how, in fact, first of all, I hope you agree with me, but secondly, how do you get the science into places like this, like the museum, so that when you've administered the oxygen, patients also got some fun things to do?
Right. Well, there are a lot of questions in what you just asked.
Right.
The first was about teachers. And teachers are being unfairly dumped upon. And I work with thousands and thousands of teachers over the years, so it's a very large sample. The vast majority of them are fantastic professionals, being asked to do an astonishing job. And if I might, I'll use another medical analogy. If a patient walked into a doctor's office and that patient smoked cigarettes and was 100 pounds overweight, would we hold the doctor responsible for that patient's health? I think not. It's an individual choice. So for many of these teachers, their patients are walking into the classroom with enormous deficits. And we're saying, you're responsible. Well, they're not responsible. We're all responsible. And some people say you can't make excuses, but it's very important to identify reasons so we can address the reasons. And a lot of the reasons why teachers are being challenged is because of the environment within which the kids are brought up.
Yeah.
Now, we can address some of those in highly focused schools where we have examples of the best principals and the best teachers brought together. But that's all about the best. It's almost like comparing any hospital to the Mayo Clinic and saying, why can't they all be that way? So teachers are being unfairly dumped upon. In terms of understanding what the science is, I think what places like children's museums have done is to translate the science into incredible interactive experiences that are a lot of fun, so the parents and children want to be engaged. But I think the next generation of what we have to do is to find ingenious ways to expose the parents to the learning that's going on an intellectual basis. So when the children are playing with blocks, what are they learning about spatial arrangements and mathematics? And how can we make the parents aware of what that learning is? And how can we provide them with the techniques of questioning and language that enhances the learning without making everybody crazy about it, because we don't want to overdo it? You know, for some of the parents who actually have read some of the science, they take it to an extreme. Not everything has to be a learning moment. In fact, many things shouldn't be a learning moment. The children should be left alone. Let them have free play. But there's enough now that we know about how the brain works, even using MRIs. It's one of the great reasons for putting the arts back into the school and the life of a child. The research that was done by the Dana Foundation recently in great symposia that shows how the brain fires in different regions when children are exposed to music or to the arts is tremendous evidence about how it really activates those neurons. What are the exact mechanisms? Well, maybe we don't know yet. But I have a different way of looking at it, because we're a grassroots organization. I look at the child's eyes. And as we look at those eyes, you have to look into them and understand through their eyes what's going on inside their mind. You can see the connections being made. And there's something else I actually listen for. If a child is engaged in an activity where he or she is discovering how to do something, when they actually do it, is there's a funny little giggle that they have. And that little giggle is a sign of self-satisfaction and accomplishment. And that's really at the root of education. And you don't find that when a child finishes a worksheet. Basically, they put it away and try to forget about it. So in alternative places, like a children's museum, a science museum, a YMCA, a Boys and Girls Club, how do we make the learning visible? How do we take the neuroscience and distill it? But it shouldn't be distilled so it's a science lesson. And I'll give you a concrete example that we're engaged in right now. The Children's Museum of Manhattan is working with the NIH on preventing childhood obesity, which is surprising to people. What's a children's museum doing preventing childhood obesity? Well, the reason is that we're talking about changing behavior. And changing behavior is a combination of cognitive and affective education. If changing behavior was only about people acquiring knowledge, nobody would smoke cigarettes. Everybody knows it's bad for you. It's emotional. And when we talk about food, it's emotional. So how do we get at that? And that's where some of the brain science is really interesting. As we study executive function in the brain, how we make decisions, how we delay gratification, how we teach that to children, that's at the heart of our work now in creating a new exhibition. It's about the decision-making. You don't necessarily need to know the chemical process by which you metabolize fat or don't metabolize fat. You need to know how you can regulate yourself in terms of your decision making when it comes to eating and physical activity, and now critically important, sleep, because there's a connection between sleep and obesity. So the work that we do to change behavior needs to be informed by all of the science, but it needs to be translated into fun, intergenerational fun, where the magic really happens, and it needs to be about behavior change and suggestions for the things that you can do at home that are going to be productive in your child's growth and development.
One of the reasons that we do not only the science of educating on the Science Network, there's also a section that's devoted to sleep research, mm-hmm. a section devoted to nutrition, aging research as well, because these are, as you said, interconnected. Now, earlier I did not mean to be dismissive of or insensitive to the passion that goes into this debate at the political level mm-hmm. about teachers, schools, school boards and all that sort of stuff. But it did seem to me, and again, maybe I'm being a devil's advocate here, correct me if I'm wrong, but our position is to say, well, this debate is somewhat vacuous until everybody's agreed about what you can do with a brain, and that seems to me to be a scientific story at its root. So if we understood the neuroscience, and the neuroscience was then injected into these various areas where this debate is happening, then we'd have possibly more success. For example, if you had a time when you have low budgets and you cut out physical education or music, scientists would tell you pretty quickly that hippocampus is a really useful thing to have, happy, yeah. and that's something that involves spatial and memory, not a good idea to get rid of physical education. Music is extremely good in terms mm-hmm. of temporal dynamics.
And mathematics.
I mean, you know where I'm going with this.
Absolutely.
So it does seem to be important, really, to get more of a message out there about what the neuroscience can tell us, what the cognitive science can tell us, so that these decisions, when they're made, are informed decisions.
I agree. The neuroscience tells us one really, really important thing, and that's its education's a long process. The brain develops from the time a child is born and doesn't fully develop, probably till 23, in terms of the prefrontal lobe. Here's the rub. Education needs to be a longitudinal process. And the investment, in particular, in early childhood education is very difficult to measure, and the results of it may not show up for years. The political process is show me results today. So the science is saying we need to invest over a long period of time and we'll wait for the results, which scientists do. And the political process can't do that because the cycle of elections and action and a country that wants short-term immediate results with a magic pill doesn't jive with the long-term results. For example, as soon as a child is born, and maybe before, we should bathe them in language. We should be talking to them and with them. But a child doesn't talk when they're 6 months old or 9 months old. But we know the investment long term will result in a child who will eventually read and have good language. We need to take that patience and that belief in the longitudinal effect of what we do and let it crystallize, let it germinate. The political environment is not about that. So oftentimes, what I see funders, foundations, beginning to look at, say, a program for adolescents because they can test it. They can say, all right, we taught the adolescent this, and they can respond, and we can see the result. God, you know, it's really difficult in early childhood. It's very difficult to see the result. Although we're beginning to, and there's a lot of good information and good science about it, but you truly have to wait a long time to see its full germination. So when I talk to folks about early childhood, everybody nods in agreement. They say, yes, you know, we really need to do that. But it's really hard to measure, isn't it? You have to wait a long time, and there's too many variables. We can't isolate them. But, the neuroscience is very clear about the first 3 or 4 years of life in terms of brain development.
There's a considerable body of work already out there that people could draw on.
And we're trying. And now the medical community, in terms of nutrition, are looking at things like portion control being set at a very young age, so that our anti-obesity efforts have to be addressed in the neonatal and early childhood arena, because that's when a lot of this is formulated, not just biologically, but emotionally once again. You know, if a child is given a 12-ounce bottle of milk to drink, the child learns that to satisfy the parent, they should drink the whole bottle, even though they don't need all of that milk. And so now we've set an interaction where the child is beginning to overeat to please the parent, which is very important to a young child. So somehow the neuroscience hasn't penetrated really the political arena to really inform policy on all levels. And I think what we need to do now, because we have so much neuroscience, is can we get the scientists and the educators who understand this together as a really important advocacy group and begin to talk locally to boards of education, talk to politicians. And here's a big rub, the press. There's nobody who has a beat in the press for families. What's happened now is that there's almost an alternative press and blogs bringing information to families. But the big publications, the major daily newspapers, have no reporter who's assigned to cover things related to families, which is quite odd since most human beings live in family-based units. There's a K-12 reporter, there's an arts reporter, there's a science reporter. But when you talk to them about the beat for families, and look what it's mirrored in. Federal, state, or local government. Where's the Department of Family? It doesn't exist. So we've chopped everybody into these artificial bits when, in fact, most of us live in family units. And because the human species produces offspring that are the most immature of any species, family is critical to our survival, and yet we ignore it. So the way policy is structured and practice is structured is actually completely against the neuroscience. But it's an enormous reversal that needs to take place. And at least in my view, the key political hurdle is, how do you work with families? Because in America, it's been a very individualistic society, and we don't have the mechanism to work with families. So the default mechanism is to work with the schools. And it's too late, and it's insufficient. So if the neuroscience is not being listened to, it's because there's no mechanism. There's no press mechanism, there's no natural government mechanism, and there's no system to reach families the way there are to reach children in the school system. So I think that's why we're running up against a brick wall, if you would. And so we're talking about enormous cultural and societal change in order to have the science not only be taken seriously, but to find a way to apply it. And it may well be that the new media, the blogging, and the things that go directly to parents will result in a whole new and very dynamic system of reaching families. Whether it can penetrate all the different economic classes remains to be seen. It will be a challenge, because right now we're probably talking to only a certain group of America who's tied into this, sometimes a little bit over-tied into it, and a little bit overzealous about things. But those are some of the structural issues, at least in my view, from being here on the ground, that prevents the neuroscience from being understood and applied.
What's the profile of the people who come through here?
Oh, it's the profile of New York. And we've worked hard. We had a symposium, National Science Foundation symposium, here on Saturday. And during a break, people went out and they looked in this museum's galleries. It was a weekend. It was all families, and from every background you can imagine. That doesn't happen by itself. We work at it every day. And it's economically difficult. Only 4 out of 10 people who come to this museum pay admission. So we every Head Start family in this city can come to this museum for free whenever they want. That's just Head Start. We have 75 community-based organizations we work with who people can buy $5 memberships. Target sponsors free Friday nights at the museum. We frequently have free days. So, you know, sometimes in the United States, things are cast in kind of racial overtones. You know, is your audience people of color? But a lot of it's class-based. So we've crossed that barrier, but we want a step further. We weren't happy 4 or 5 years ago about the number of Latino families visiting the museum. And it's not just about having an evening. So we partnered with Nickelodeon and created an exhibition based upon Dora the Explorer. And Dora's a heroine in the Latino community. Latino audience went up like that. And there's great science lessons, by the way, in that exhibition about caring for animals and about animal anatomy, because Diego loves the environment. So it's a way of teaching science without teaching a science. And that's the great thrill of working in a children's museum. By training, I'm an archaeologist. I never thought I'd work in a children's museum.
I was just going to say to you, when you were a kid walking through some museum, you weren't looking around thinking, I'm going to run one of these one day, were you?
No. You know, look, my whole career was defined by really two moments. Yeah. And none of it had to do with school. I think I was in fourth grade, and I was homesick, which was very unusual, because in my house you had to be virtually dead to stay home from school. And I had taken a book out of the library, a book called All About Dinosaurs by Roy Chapman Andrews. And I was homesick, and I devoured the book. And then it was visits to the Museum of Natural History to see the dinosaurs. Those two experiences led me into a cognate field. It wasn't paleontology, but it was archaeology. I never thought I'd work in a museum. I thought I probably would be an academic. And by the way, for a kid growing up in the Bronx, to think about being an archaeologist was quite unusual. You know, it's not exactly was the normative path. But being an archaeologist, I began to work in museums. And so the power of working with families and children. A children's museum has a huge advantage over a science museum and an art museum. Our society self-selects about almost everything. So there's a great science museum in a city, and a lot of parents go, ooh, I don't really do science. Or a great art museum, and I say, I don't really do art. So they self-select to not go. Children's museum, oh, okay, it's for the children. Yeah. It's safe. So we've done a number of incredible scientific exhibitions here, working with some of the best scientists. And we work with them to translate the science for the parents, because parents don't want to seem foolish in front of their kids. Things even like immunology. And everybody's relaxed here because it's just for the kids. So everything's presented in a way that's digestible to the kids. So the parents are learning. But they will stumble upon things here, whether it's science or art or history, that they wouldn't go to an institution only devoted to those subjects. And that's the great advantage to being a general place like a children's museum. Because we have a fear of science. We have a fear of art. People have been brought up to say, that's not what I do. So how do we find the alternative venues that people will stumble into something, and the kids will too, and have the same experience I did growing up? You cannot predict when that aha or wow experience will happen. And yet, what we're trying to do is structure everything so we can measure what the learning is. I would put forth to you that the structured learning is actually not what's most important. What's most important is finding your passion. And when a child or a person finds their passion and what they love, they will find a way to pursue it. They'll overcome whatever obstacle they have in terms of learning or access if that passion is there. We can't program passion, but we can provide a range of opportunities, exposures to different type of scientists or artists or humanists, as many as we can, so that each child has an opportunity to find what they're good at, how they're naturally good at learning, and what they're passionate about. And that's what we've taken away. We've, in a sense, also forced kids to over-specialize at a very young age. Look at sports. I love sports, and it's great that kids are involved in sports. I was a coach for many years. I coached basketball for 7 years. But we're forcing kids, in the name of excellence, at a young age to specialize. And what's happening? They're injured. They're pitching too many pitches. They have a rotator cuff problem. They're swimming too much. They have shoulder problems. They're playing too much basketball and not working their whole body. So there are need problems that we haven't seen in children, usually in adults. And we're beginning to do the same thing with academic subjects. You know, some years ago, there was the former chancellor of the New York City school system, as many years ago, Tony Alvarado, who was a friend, said, you know, we do something very peculiar. We find out what kids are bad at, and what do? We give them more of it. So you're not good at math? Let's give you extra math. But hold it, I'm good in art. We'll take that away because you need extra math. So a child may be expressing a passion in some subject, and we focus on what they're not good at. Now that, and what do we do in the process? We destroy their passion. So somehow we have to find a way to encourage that passion. And yeah, it's important to know math, and it's important to read, but let's not do that and forsake what the child may be passionate about. If you gave me a job where you kept giving me more of what I'm bad at, I don't think I'd be very happy. You know?
Let me ask you a question that I ask everybody about the administration's pledge to restore science to its rightful place. Where is that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what that means. You know? Well, the first thing is to take science seriously. And I think this administration in Washington does take it seriously. I think there's a respect for science that sometimes we haven't seen. The question is do we take the respect for science and do we apply it across the spectrum of life and begin to understand what that means politically? Because I remember the Museum of Natural History did a survey that 50% of the public does not believe in evolution. Well, politically, teaching evolution is a problem. And it creates voting problems. So how much the belief in science jives with the politics really remains to be seen. But I would ask a kind of a separate question in terms of education, which I don't think has been well defined. When we talk about the deficit in what's called STEM, you know, science and technology and math, are we talking about creating more experts who become engineers and scientists? Or are we talking about an educated population across the board? Or are we talking about both? Because those are two very different things in terms of how you want to structure what we're trying to accomplish. And trying to do both at the same time is quite difficult. So I don't think that's been well defined enough in terms of where we want to be going. There's a lot of talk that America's behind in education. For those parents of the 1 million or 2 million children right now applying for college, they would probably scratch their head. Getting into a good college is really hard. There are so many good kids who are so well educated. They're having trouble getting into school. The issue is we have a bifurcation in our society. There's a huge percentage not graduating and a huge percentage who are excelling. America is still producing students at a wonderful number who are excelling. Our problem is the bifurcation. And I don't believe it's the fault of the education system, particularly when you look at things historically. For example, even as late as the 1970s, we were not worried about the dropout rate. Because if you dropped out of high school, you could get a blue-collar job and earn a living and support your family. But all of a sudden, beginning in the 80s, everything changed. We became a knowledge culture, a technology culture. Blue-collar jobs disappeared because we mechanized everything. So all of a sudden, from historical terms, overnight, we said to the school system, hello, everybody now needs to graduate. That wasn't an expectation before. We may not want to say that, but it's true. So now we have a different set of expectations and the same system. And we're trying the same stuff that worked in the old system, in a new system. I think it was Einstein, maybe it wasn't, who said the definition of insanity is if you keep trying the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. Well, we're trying the same system and expecting a different result. In fact, I think we've done extraordinarily well because we haven't reduced the number of graduates in a world where the set of expectations and challenges are much greater. So keeping a needle where it is actually a huge accomplishment educationally. When we're working in the South Bronx with a focus group of 60 families. They come from different parts of Mexico, some who don't speak Spanish, the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Tibet, and parts of Africa. Well, we haven't ever tried this before now, have we? I thought when I grew up in New York it was diverse, but it's nothing like what we're seeing now. So we are behind the demographics. We don't understand the current demographics and how quickly they're changing. And what I'm seeing today in terms of some of our communities with these disparate groups in the same neighborhood, just imagine a generation or two from now when they begin to intermarry. So our challenge in a diverse American population is unlike anything the world has ever seen. And so we are in a grand experiment right now educationally. And instead of knocking ourselves, we have to embrace the challenge. We have to engage the neuroscientists and the behavioral scientists in helping us to understand how we address this new population in a new climate where we can't have people who don't graduate high school or college. This is brand new. You know, as an archaeologist, I'll tell you 20 years is a pretty short period of time, or 25, or 50 years. And yet we have all of these dynamic changes. The only thing I think changing faster than technology in this country is demographics, and we're not aware of it. We just don't see it. I have a son who's 25. His worldview and his peers' worldview is very different than mine. They're going to intermarry in all different ways at a completely different rate than any other generation. They're over it. If they meet somebody they fall in love with, they're getting married. They're going to procreate. So we're going to have a whole range of kids from multiple cultures and multiple backgrounds, multiple linguistic traditions. We're not prepared for that. How could we be? It's never happened before. So I'll circle back to the neuroscience. We're going to be asking our neuroscientists a whole different set of questions. You know, what does it mean when a child is growing up with three or four different cultures, three or four different languages at home? How do we study that? What does it mean in terms of brain development and behavioral development? We have some studies, you know, but they're obsolete because it's changing so rapidly. Fortunately, the technology in terms of studying the brain is developing as quickly as the demographics. But we have a whole new set of questions. And how we answer those questions is only step one. The real step is how do we get it into practice?
Well, I remember seeing yesterday in the Ultimate Block Party a demonstration from Patricia Kuhl and Andy Meltzoff doing bilingual bingo, which was producing a huge amount of interest. And of course, has got strong neuroscience underpinnings and applications. So, be interested to see how all this goes. I'd like to come back and spend some time at your museum when we're next visiting, but it's been great talking to you, Andy Ekman.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.